Iran's president says it can be a sign of seriousness in the negotiations if the U.S. voices readiness to remove sanctions. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says the U.S. is seeking to ignite a civil war in his country. Also ahead, gunmen kill more than 40 people in an attack on a village market in northwest Nigeria. Thank you for joining us. Our top story for this hour, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says talks on the 2015 nuclear deal should have tangible results for the Islamic Republic.
Iran has never left the negotiating table, and we are serious about result-oriented talks. The other side can show seriousness by voicing its readiness to remove the cruel sanctions.
In a televised interview, Raisi also noted that Iran has been adhering to its nuclear deal-related commitments and will continue to do so. He made the comments as the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, are set to resume talks in a few weeks. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi warned about the presence of Daesh terrorists in the region. He underlined the necessity for the establishment of peace and stability in Afghanistan for the sake of regional security. The Iranian president also called for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan, warning that a government comprised of one political or ethnic group cannot resolve the problems of the war-stricken nation. Iran's foreign minister says his country will return to full compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal if other signatories to the accord do the same. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with UN Chief Antonio Guterres. The top Iranian diplomat also described the recent meeting between Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Balqari and EU Envoy Enrique Mora as positive. Amir Abdullahian said Iran will follow up talks with the 27-nation bloc in Brussels. This, as EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said he was willing to talk with Iranian representatives if they needed some clarifications before resuming talks on the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. Iran and the remaining signatories have held 6 rounds of talks in the Austrian capital since April to restore the troubled pact. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the Lebanese Forces Party was behind the killing of 7 Shia protesters in Beirut last Thursday. Maryam Saleh has more.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayed Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baal Bag al-Hermel. We were killed in Chaldea and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrullah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
So Yemenis have gathered in the capital Sana'a and across and other cities across the country to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam. Abdul Latif al-Washadi has more in this report.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam is a religion of peace. Our nation will stick to its identity and values regardless of wars and aggressive policies. Problems have only strengthened us in the face of the enemies of Islam.
For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Abdul Washali, Sana.
Celebrations are also underway across Britain to mark the birthday of Islam's beloved and holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Thousands of British Muslims have held public prayers and gatherings, the biggest of which was in the English town of Bolton. Our UK correspondent Robert Carter was invited to join these celebrations.
Thousands of Muslims gathered in the English town of Bolton on Sunday to celebrate a joyous occasion, the birthday of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. The birthday of the prophet, also known as Maulid al-Nabi, is commemorated in Rabi al-Awwal, the third month in the Islamic calendar.
These local Muslims are very excited about coming out to commemorate this day, as last year coronavirus restrictions prevented them from doing so. However, things are now returning to normal here in the UK, and these Muslims are coming out in strong numbers from across the country to commemorate the beloved birthday of Islam's holy prophet.
Apart from bringing Muslims together, it also provides a great opportunity to spread his legacy to non-Muslims too.
This is our message to everyone. All the humankind, you know, in this planet, that we should live each other, we love in harmony, and the teaching of our Holy Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is for all humankind. So this is why we are celebrating today.
In recent months, the beloved Prophet has been the target of insult in Europe, but these Muslims hope to break the many misconceptions.
It's been happening over a number of years. There's been very negative propaganda against Islam and particularly Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. But having said that, people with a bit of common sense, they try to study Islam, try to learn Seerah of Islam, and you'd be amazed, they most of them become Muslim.
And when he studied different aspects of his life, his childhood, him as a husband, him as a father, him as a friend, him as a leader of his community, then he realized what a great person he is. And he'll get rid of a lot of the misconceptions and misunderstandings. And once you do some research and you speak to Muslims and you study his life, it'll enlighten you, and you know, you'll hold him in a very high regard.
In addition to prayers, Quran readings, and the march, sweets and free ice cream were handed out, all in honour of the Prophet's generous nature. Robert Carter, Bolton.
Laureates of the 4th Mustafa Prize are in Iran to exchange views on ways to promote science and technology in the Muslim world. The Mustafa Prize is a science and technology award granted to Muslim scientists from around the world every 2 years. Yusuf Jalali reports.
With a few days to go to the 4th Mustafa Prize, the laureates of the Science and Technology Award are gearing up to nab the prize. The 5 winners were announced on October 12th in a press conference held in the headquarters of the Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation. They're now in Iran, visiting different scientific entities, including Iran's High Council for Cultural Revolution. They're here to talk about their scientific achievements and the significance of the international prize.
I'm extremely happy to be selected for this prestigious Mustafa Prize. It's a big honor and a great privilege to see that our collective effort with international collaboration, Atlas, Antares, and KM3Net recognized with this prestigious prize. And I would thank a lot and all my gratitude to the Mustafa Foundation for this noble and for this exemplary manner they are doing their work to promote scientific excellence in the Muslim world.
First launched in 2015, the Mustafa Prize honors scientific breakthroughs in the Muslim world. It is awarded to Muslim scientists in 4 categories of information and communication science and technology, life and medical science and technology, nanoscience and nanotechnology, and all areas of science and technology. This year, out of 515 works submitted to the Iran-based Secretariat, 5 nominees were selected as winners. Laureates will be granted cash prizes amounting to $1 million.
In the last 4 decades, we have been working in the field of natural parachemistry, and that has resulted in the discovery of many drugs.
That's why you are going to receive the award.
Yeah, I feel extremely honored to receive this very prestigious award. This award is already very well known globally because of its excellence, and the quality of assessment to select people is absolutely wonderful.
The scientific event is held biannually during the Islamic Unity Week, which celebrates the birthday of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the award ceremony falls on October 21st in Tehran, with the attendance of 50 scientists and scholars from 15 countries.
The Mustafa Prize says after 4 rounds, it has achieved its primary goal: to motivate Muslim scientists to compete for excellence. But the prize eyes for a bigger goal. It says it seeks to elevate science and technology in Muslim countries to, quote, revive the Islamic golden age in science. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Unidentified gunmen have killed at least 43 people in Nigeria's south-northwest Sokoto state. A state government spokesman said heavily armed gangs known locally as bandits raided a weekly market in a village. He said the market was crowded with shoppers and traders when the attack took place. Earlier this month, a similar gang attack in another village in a district near the border with Niger left 19 people dead. Bandits have terrorized northwest and central Nigeria for years. But attacks have become more violent in recent months, forcing thousands of locals to flee their homes. Nigerian troops have been conducting air and ground operations against the bandit camps since last month. Thousands of protesters have staged a sit-in calling on the military to dissolve Sudan's transitional government. Demonstrators have set up a protest camp in front of the presidential palace. They say the interim government has failed them both politically and economically, calling on the army to seize power. In an urgent cabinet meeting, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described the situation as the worst and most dangerous crisis since President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. The military is demanding reforms and the replacement of the cabinet following a failed coup attempt in September by Bashir loyalists. This has raised fears of a military power grab. The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, and his wife Zinat have sued the Nigerian secret police for withholding their passports. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zinat are asking the Nigerian court to enforce their fundamental right to movement by ordering the Nigerian Department of State Services to release their passports. The case filed by Zakzaki's lawyers at the Federal High Court, Abuja, indicated that the secret police have placed a red flag and travel restrictions on the passports of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife.
We made several frantic efforts to get his passport back from them, so that now the trial having been concluded and they having been discharged and acquitted, we made requisitions to the states to avail them their passports so that they can, as free citizens, travel out. But the states turned down this request.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zinat need their passports to travel for urgent medical treatment abroad. Zazaki's lawyer said that placing restrictions on the passports of the Islamic cleric and his wife constitutes a threat to their lives. The case has just been filed and will only come up for hearing when it has been assigned to a judge. But Zazaki's lawyers are optimistic that the hearing will commence soon.
Sheikh Zakzaki is reported to have a dangerous and an unusual amount of lead and cadmium in his blood when he was shot by Nigerian security forces. His doctors have since advised that Zakzaki be immediately hospitalized to remove the dangerous substances from his body. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Can America's self-styled foreign policy experts be expected to learn from the failures of the latest misadventure in Afghanistan? If history is an indicator, there is little reason to believe the foreign policy blob will learn the error of their ways. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jose Nino Ryder. This article is titled, Don't Expect American Foreign Policy Experts to be Held Accountable for Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. Can America's self-styled foreign policy experts be expected to learn from the failures of the latest misadventure in Afghanistan? If history is an indicator, there is little reason to believe the foreign policy blob will learn the error of their ways. The horrific events of 9/11 inevitably brought the U.S. back to Afghanistan, but this time with a full-fledged military force. To say this military venture was a boondoggle would be an understatement. The financial cost of U.S. 20-year Afghan conflict have been staggering, with estimates from Brown University's Cost of War project pointing to $2.3 trillion spent in this war effort. Over 2,400 American service members lost their lives, along with 71,000 Afghan civilians during the war. Narratives put forth by neoliberal and neoconservative interventionists regarding the nature of 9/11 attacks missed the mark. The cliché of "they hate us for our freedoms" used to explain why the country was attacked on 9/11 conveniently overlooks the repeated overreach of the U.S. in foreign affairs since the Second World War. Bold political actions abroad generally provoke some form of reaction. Whether it's a blowback on lurid display during 9/11 or the formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a response to the West's geopolitical encroachments on the Eurasian landmass. From funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to arming the so-called moderate rebels in Syria, constantly putting the figurative Vladimir Lenin in a train car to St. Petersburg is not a viable ground strategy for U.S. foreign policy. This type of geopolitical trickery creates a multitude of unintended consequences that are detrimental to U.S. security in the long term. Thinking through the second and third order effects of interventions has never been a strong suit of the D.C. blob. The cold, hard truth is that the high-time preference nature of the present-day political order clouds the judgment of policymakers and does not allow them to see how their interventions could blow up in their faces in the long term. Nevertheless, the world of geopolitics has an uncanny way of bringing the most fantastical of political projects back down to reality. The U.S. liberal hegemony crusades have hit the proverbial wall of nationalism. International relations specialist John Mearsheimer has long argued that nationalism is the most powerful force in international relations, a force that stops the most utopian of nation-building architects' fantasies dead in their tracks. In the Afghan case, it was easy to see why a sizable portion of the population turned to the Taliban for security. The combination of introducing culturally alien norms such as Western-style feminism and ramped-up drone operations, one of the low points of the Trump administration, greatly facilitated the Taliban's return to power. Foreign powers intervening in a given nation usually provoke a nationalist backlash and allow for the hometown resistance to look like a popular alternative in the eyes of people, no matter how brutal these resistance forces may be, as in the case of the Taliban. At the end of the day, the corporate press enthusiastic praise of Ashraf Ghani's administration belied an otherwise non-existent support base that the Afghan government enjoyed. That house of cards came tumbling down once the U.S. began an earnest withdrawal from the country. It's anyone's guess how Afghanistan will shape up politically in the near future. It remains to be seen if the Taliban government will carry out the massive reprisals against individuals and groups who cooperated with the U.S. puppet government. Due to the fractious nature of Afghan politics, some form of civil war breaking out in the country is not out of the question. Knowing U.S. foreign policy inclinations all too well, it's no stretch to imagine the U.S. later taking the side of moderate rebels in such a hypothetical scenario, the same way the U.S. has during the Syrian war. Even when military expeditions look like they're concluding, the U.S. security establishment always finds ways to reinsert itself in conflict zones. The cynic sees the Afghanistan pullout as a temporary retrenchment for the U.S. while it momentarily recharges in preparation for fights with bigger fish in the vast ocean of geopolitics. The formation of the AUK-US trilateral military pact between Australia, the UK, and the United States is perhaps the first sign of a genuine pivot toward Asia with the aim of containing the rise of China, a task that will require a major concentration of U.S. military resources. Great power conflict is the major league of international struggles, and it could potentially bring about devastation that would make the failed nation-building projects of Afghanistan and Iraq look like small potatoes in comparison. Much to the dismay of anyone who desires a more restrained foreign policy, failing forward is par for the course in D.C. foreign policy circles. No kind of punishment or demotion of those who prosecuted the bungled wars of the past few decades should be expected. Until there is a new foreign policy class informed by an outlook of restraint, the permutations of interventionism will persist throughout DC political circles. Calamity awaits those who persist in pursuing imperial delusions.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. So for today's discussion, we want to be concerned with a very important topic as tackled by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and that is the position of men and women in Islam. Especially the Western world has got misunderstood the position of women And the women are looking after the rice in the wrong picture that has been made for them. Because the women nowadays, especially in the feminism and the feminist look that they have, are looking for the instrumental look of the men too. And this is absolutely the materialistic look, the bodily physical look that the men and women have at each other and are looking after their own rights in this framework. And just take a look at what is happening in today's world, for example, Me Too movement. You know, these are the women who are looking after their rights because they have been abused, misused, or raped, you know, especially in the cinematic form or by the artists here and there. This is not only limited, of course, to the actresses, but all the women, you know, in different classes of the society. And the major question is this. When you wanted to get into the industry, by any means, weren't you thinking about this? That you are an absolute instrument of the play and power? Now we're gonna make a movement. Say, Me Too. I have been raped and I have been abused by the men. And you know, just take a look at this, that the men also claiming this too, okay? You know, this is really funny, you know, what's happening around us in today's world. And just look that how much the people are affected by the power of the media. I mean, how limited a look of the women and men in today's world must be at the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. That this is the men and this is the women, and they have been limited their powers, their rights, this and that. Based on what? Based on sexuality and based on sexual desires or this and that. Is this why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us? I mean, the power that they put us in?
Regarding the Me Too movement, your response is basically blaming the victim. Right? You should have thought about this before.
I'm not blaming blaming the victim. I said they are the victim of the policies that they have been living in.
Yeah, the thing is it's much more complicated, and you know that we're having similar movements in religious circles as well.
Yes.
Like we have this face movement and
yes.
The spiritual abuse,
yes.
stuff like that, even in Muslim communities. I think, you know, they're looking at it in a very simplistic, an oversimplified view of the problem. And at least in the Muslim community, if you want to fix the issue that is there, there's no denying that. We need to still look at how religion and our scripture require us to face these issues. We cannot just make up our own rules and follow the trends to fix the problem.
So, you know, for example, from the other side, the religion of Islam is also criticized nowadays
yeah.
for not having the enough respect for the women
yeah.
and especially the women rights, okay? So what would be the answer to that one? I mean, from the Western one.
If you look at the Muslim world, right, the Muslims are a separate thing from Islam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now we don't have the perfect community. We're not in the utopia of Islam right now. So I think one of the ahadith that can give us a clue about the view of Islam is a very controversial one when you look at the surface. It's narrated that the Prophet asked his companions, what is the best thing for women? And Imam Ali alayhi salam went to his house, asked the same question from Sayyida Zahra salamullah alayha.
Okay.
And Lady Zahra salamullah alayha said, the best thing for a woman is to not see a man and not be seen by a man.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds very radical,
yes.
right? But when we look at the life of Lady Fatima, that's not the case. Men used to see him, used to see her. Prophet would tell everyone, if you don't know this, this is Fatima bint Muhammad. Man adaha faqad adani. And after the decease of the Prophet, Lady Fatima came to to masjid, gave a very strong lecture. So she was in the society. So what does this mean? My understanding of this hadith is women in general must be in the society. Like, women have a role in society, right? But when you're in the society, when you're acting in the society, you must leave your gender behind. Leave your gender in the house, whether you're a man or a woman. When I look at you, I must be seeing a human who is very intellectual, who is very creative,
okay,
who is very powerful.
Is it possible, Sheikh? I mean, for example, consider the, you know, according to the statistics, the women are the attractive sex and the attractive gender, and this is not only in Islam but
to heterosexual men. Yes.
You know, no, this is the absolute form, okay? That sexually speaking,
yeah, you could say they are associated more with beauty, but attractiveness is subjective.
Or beauty, or I don't know, attracting this and that, okay? But the case is that so women with all these potentials and the powers, when she is present in the society, you know, here and there, okay, is it possible for the men just look at her as an intellectual entity and not the attractive one?
Definitely, yes.
Is it possible from the side of the men?
Yes.
I mean, this is the ideal world you are picturing, okay? This must be so. But I think it is not possible.
The problem is the way women are being presented in society and the way they think
don't you think that the role of the women is defined somewhere else rather than this? The very
in the
society.
Kitchen?
No, I'm not talking about the kitchen. I'm not talking about the kitchen. Okay. See, can I as a man be a mother?
No.
No, I cannot be a mother. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I bear a child for 9 months? Can I breastfeed her or him, the child? I cannot do that. Believe me.
Yes, that's the
maybe
physical
one
difference.
Day science gets the man to a level. I don't know. It's impossible. But making a man who can be pregnant or something like that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do not do that. So just consider this 9 months of pregnancy of the women, okay? It brings its own powers, potentials, and talents for the women, which is not defined in the society but somewhere else. I do want to say that the women must be in the kitchen. Men also be in the kitchen too. But I think that the main role and the main responsibility that is put on the shoulder of a woman is nurturing, nurturing the children and looking after that, and also the husband.
Women are definitely better equipped for that.
Okay.
With the, like, they are more compassionate in general.
Yes.
They are more loyal to the family. That's definitely the case.
Yes.
But, and definitely we're not going to have more coal miners in the female side than men. But I don't think there's any problem with having more female mathematicians, for
no
example.
Problem.
Female
no
philosophers.
No problem with that.
Problem.
And in
because
Islam.
We're looking at the intellectual, the spirit side of human, which is the same in men and women.
Okay.
I think one more sentence to finalize the whole discussion. I think respected Sheikh wanted to, while strengthening the social role of the women, indirectly looks at the main role of a woman as a mother, or in her main role in upbringing of a child, and also her role in a house as a small society. So this society can be looked at and applied to a bigger one, to like the society that people are in. So all in all, the main role of women from an Islamic perspective is upbringing of a child, and at the same time, the role of a mother, and she or the lady and all the women are even allowed to have their own role in society, to continue their education like men, and to do whatever it deems necessary in a society. But I think there was a misunderstanding between us to see that all of the women are obliged to do so. No, some who believe
but
that...
But believe me, managing it is very difficult. Considering a woman who is working 7 to 9, and just getting home, not having enough time for the husband and the wife, and not, I don't know, not doing the chores of the house. And it's misplaced now. The women are working outside, the men are inside the house.
We are actually talking about its theoretical, actually, basis. Is it actually Islamically allowed for her to work in society?
Practically,
in an Islamic way, while, as the Sheikh said, leaves gender at home. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is possible, Islamically speaking. But what is the outcome and consequences? This is something actually at a second step that we need to discuss it.
I think giving value.
Yes, exactly. With everything, you have to be rational.
Yes.
Like, we're not giving prescriptions to every single woman or every single man.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, fatherhood is very important. We have psychological papers now that say if fathers are not present in a family, children will not be as organized.
Yes.
They will not be disciplined. So a mother cannot play that role.
That's
but
right.
But do and we say that the main role of man in general is fatherhood? Yes, in the house,
and please,
man is better to be a father and woman should be the mother, right?
Yeah.
And no one questions that. But what about the society?
But I do want to say that the West is criticizing the Muslims nowadays because they are looking after the women and women, according to their own definition. They have the same sex parents
but
now.
That's
okay?
not
See?
Just about the
Look
woman. It's about the family. Like, the role of family is becoming weaker and weaker in
yes.
the Western society.
Okay.
If we fix that, we might be able to have a tranquil and rational equilibrium between men and women in society.
Just look at how's the family defined nowadays in the Western world. For example, the same-sex parents. I mean, a child having two women as the parents or two men as the parents or single-parent family. These are all, come on, they're new forms of the families, and you have to accept that, do you want it or not. Come on, man. Bullshit. I think bullshit. This is not the family we are looking for. This is not the value system. Judging the women and men according to their own values, potentials, and talents is possible. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. If non-Muslims want to be more familiar with the Islamic look at the women and men, they have to get to the original sources and not the media, okay? This is the case, definitely, and we have so many verses of the Holy Quran and the Hadith giving importance to the position of men and women as the same in the society. Even in the Holy Quran, the name of the title men and women are repeated 24 times as equal to each other. So the Quran also did justice towards the role of the men and women in the society. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali, for a nice elaboration regarding the topic of position of men and women in the society according to the speeches of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Some House and Senate Democrats smarting from a move by Senator Joe Manchin III, Democrat of West Virginia, to kill a major element of President Biden's climate plan, are switching to Plan B, a tax on carbon dioxide pollution. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Coral Davenport, Luke Broadwater, Emily Cottrain, and Zolan Kano Youngs. The piece is titled Democrats Weigh Carbon Tax After Manchin Rejects Key Climate Provision. Some House and Senate Democrats smarting from a move by Senator Joe Manchin III, Democrat of West Virginia, to kill a major element of President Biden's climate plan are switching to Plan B, a tax on carbon dioxide pollution. A carbon tax in which polluting industries would pay a fee for every ton of carbon dioxide they emit is seen by economists as the most effective way to cut the fossil fuel emissions that are heating the planet. The almost certain demise of the clean electricity program at the heart of President Biden's agenda, which comes as scientists say forceful policies are needed to avert climate change's most devastating impacts, has prompted outrage among many Democrats and has led several to say now is the moment for a carbon tax. I've had a carbon pricing bill in my desk for the last 3 years, just waiting for the right time, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. What has been striking is the number of senators who've come to me about this since early fall, after Louisiana got clobbered with storms, the East Coast flooding, the bootleg wildfires here in my own state of Oregon, said Senator Wyden, speaking by telephone on Saturday, 16th of October, from Oregon. Now there are a number of senators, key moderate senators, who've said they're open to this, and a lot of House folks who have said they would support it if the Senate sends it over. But a carbon tax can be politically explosive. Industries could pass along their higher costs, leaving President Biden and fellow Democrats vulnerable to claims that they're raising taxes on the middle class at a moment when inflation and energy prices are rising. Environmental justice advocates say a carbon tax permits companies to continue polluting, albeit at a higher cost, which disproportionately harms low-income communities. And it is unclear if Senator Manchin, whose vote is crucial to President Biden's legislative agenda, would support a carbon tax. As a result, the White House is scrambling to come up with alternatives to replace the $150 billion clean electricity program that had been the centerpiece of President Biden's climate agenda until just days ago, when Senator Manchin indicated he strongly opposed it. That program would have rewarded utilities that stopped burning fossil fuels in favor of wind, solar, and nuclear energy, and penalized those that did not. It was intended to push the nation's electricity sector to generate 80% of its power from clean energy sources by 2030, from 40% now. As they seek alternatives, White House officials are also weighing a voluntary version of a cap-and-trade program, which would create a market for polluters to buy and sell allowances for a certain amount of emissions. They're also considering adding to the $300 billion in clean energy tax incentives and credits that remain in the bill, while looking for ways to salvage some parts of the clean electricity program. A White House official said on Saturday, 16th of October, that staff members were still engaging with members of Congress and had not yet agreed to a final version of climate provisions. The cut to the climate change program could be among the first consequential decisions in what will very likely be a painful process for Democrats as they pare their ambitious $3.5 trillion domestic policy package. Senator Manchin and another Democrat, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have said they cannot support that spending level. Over the next 2 weeks, the White House will negotiate with Democrats over cuts to dozens of programs, as lawmakers try to whittle the original bill to about $2 trillion. President Biden suggested on Friday, 15th of October, that one of his agenda signature items, 2 years of free community college, was also on the chopping block, and progressive lawmakers worried about whether plans to provide paid family leave and expand Medicare to include vision, dental, and hearing benefits could survive. President Biden and Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill have set a deadline of 31st of October for a deal that would enable Democrats to pass the bill with their razor-thin majorities in both chambers of Congress. In recent days, as White House officials were trying to forge a deal, Senator Manchin told them he would not support any legislation that includes a clean electricity program. Joe Manchin, whose state is a major coal producer and who has financial ties to the coal industry, has said that abandoning fossil fuels will harm the country's energy independence and would make climate change worse. Once his opposition to the clean electricity program became public on Friday, 15th of October, several fellow Democrats expressed outrage. "We have a moral obligation and a governing mandate to pass policy that addresses climate change," the 96-member Congressional Progressive Caucus wrote on Twitter. "Inaction is not an option." For weeks, progressive Democrats have been holding rallies chanting "No climate, no deal" to pressure the White House to include strong climate provisions. Several of those rallies focused on the importance of the clean electricity program. Congress cannot afford to gut the climate provisions in the bill, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, wrote on Twitter. "This issue is bigger than ideology. It is a moral imperative for humanity and our planet's future to reduce and eventually eliminate emissions," she wrote. "There are many ways to do it, but we can't afford to give up."
Z
Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, has been involved with the No Climate, No Deal rallies. "Listen, my state is burning up. We're losing our snowpack. The oceans are acidifying, affecting our shellfish," he said on Saturday, "and this is a code red." Senator Jeff Merkley said he would not vote for a reconciliation package that did not have significant climate provisions, but he said he was open to any option that cut carbon dioxide emissions in half by 2030 and produce carbon-free electricity by 2035. He suggested additional wind and solar subsidies or proposals to speed up the transition to clean energy vehicles. The Biden team is going to have to lay out how they're going to meet those two goals, he said, because that's the way we stay on track. The clean electricity program opposed by Senator Joe Manchin was notable because it would include both incentives and penalties. Payment to electric utilities to switch to clean energy was the carrot. A penalty for companies that did not replace fossil fuels with clean energy was the stick. A carbon tax might provide a similar inducement when paired with tax incentives, analysts have said. If you were to replace the clean energy program with a price on carbon, I think that would go a long way. It would put back a lot of the stick elements that were removed, said Zeki Hausfather, a climate scientist and policy analyst at the Breakthrough Institute, an energy and climate research organization. Senator Ron Wyden's staff, which is drafting the carbon tax language, is considering a domestic carbon tax that could start at $15 to $18 per ton, and that would increase over time, according to two people familiar with the matter who were not authorized to speak on record. The tax would be applied directly to coal mining companies, large natural gas processing plants, and oil refiners, based on the emissions associated with their products, with one exception. Oil refiners would very likely be charged for producing diesel fuel and petrochemicals, but not gasoline, a way of shielding most American drivers at the pump. An important part of the policy, Senator Ron Wyden said, will be to use the revenue for tax rebates or checks for poor and working class Americans, particularly those employed in the fossil fuel industry. "You've got to show workers and families, when there's an economy in transition, that they will get their money back," he said. "They will be made whole."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.